Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Living Vertical Radio, where we change the narrative of media by introducing you to creative and innovative individuals that inspire you with their unique stories. Our host is Cestine Duckworth, and you can call in or Skype into this program by calling 1-646-668-2928 #1. Please make sure your surrounding area is quiet because this is a live program. One Sure Sign Mobile Notary of Frisco, Texas provides professional notary service across the Dallas metro area. Our notary professionals are ready to help you with loan closings, power of attorney, fingerprinting, and other notary services. We meet you at your location of choice, your home, office, hospital, or local coffee shop, convenient to your schedule. Reliable, professional, and affordable. One Sure Sign is happy to support Living Vertical Radio here in Texas. Mention you heard this ad on Living Vertical for $5 off any notary service. Interested in advertising on our podcast with a listening audience of over 800,000? You can do a 15-second business ad, a 30-second radio ad, or a 10-minute interview radio ad. Our prices start out at $50. Contact us at info@verticalmediagroup.com. Our pricing is made to give everyone the ability to advertising no matter the budget. Thank you. And here's your host, Cestine Duckworth.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Living Vertical. And today I'm happy to have David Ruggiero, who's been on our program before. Yay! So let me tell you a little bit about David, and then we're going to talk about his wonderful book. This book has just made me hungry all the way through. But David is known worldwide as a celebrity chef. His life story is one of redemption, sacrifice, and a new lease on life as an award-winning genre fiction writer. He rose to the position of top shelf at the famous La Caravelle in New York by the age of 25, and he went on to take command of Pierre Cardin's New York outpost of Maxim's de Paris, where he garnered 3 stars from the New York Times in 1995. He's also an author of 2 other cookbooks under his belt. He became known as a super chef and was called for television guest spots that quickly became opportunities. Today, David lives on the East Coast and spends his days writing mostly fiction genre. He's an Amazon best-selling author and the recipient of the Maxie Award for Best Horror 2019 for his debut horror novel, A Wistful Tale of Gods, Men, and Monsters. His second book of fiction is Say Goodbye and Goodnight was released in June 2020, and A Prison Without Locks was released in November 2020. But tonight, we're talking about his book with recipes as well. Called A Tomato Grows in Brooklyn. It's a wonderful book, and this book, I believe, came out in October of last year. So now let me introduce you to David Ruggiero. Hi, David. How are you?
How you doing? Thanks so much for having me.
I'm good.
I really appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm excited
really
to have you back. Oh, yeah, great. Oh. You know, I've been going through your book just being hungry.
Yeah, throw the diets out. Open up the book. Forget about the diets. Although to be honest with you, it's this. I wrote this book about Italian. It's not about Italian cooking. It's about Italian American cooking, and I talk about it. It's about the Italian American cooking and experience in Brooklyn, where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more than just a cookbook, because in the book I start to talk about my life before the TV cameras and the French restaurants and stuff like that. And I start to reveal a few things that not everybody knew about. But within the book, it's really a love letter to Brooklyn, to the people, because God knows Brooklyn has got more colorful people. There's more characters in Brooklyn than a Bugs Bunny cartoon. And then, you know, growing up in the 60s and 70s, then, I not only did I talk about my upbringing, but I also talk about all the crazy and colorful people and all the recipes, the home-style cooking that the Italian-Americans did in the kitchens in Brooklyn. And it was a labor of love. It wasn't hard for me. I really loved it.
Yeah, you know what? I loved it. I loved reading it. It was and for me, it was very relatable when you talk about family, life, and food, and, you know, and your heritage, and just, you know, the first part where you dedicated to your grandmother, and I said, anybody who remembers grandmother, you know, the grandmother was like she held everything together. She was the love. She was the food. She was just, you know, you just didn't, you know, and anything that was about your family, it's like grandmother, you know, held that together. So it was just wonderful tribute to your grandmother in the book.
Yeah, my grandmother, her name was, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you know, I love what you said, that she's now in heaven. She's now an angel asking God what he wants for dinner.
Yeah,
I love that.
Yeah. Her name was Mary Lazzarino. She was a very special woman, and
mm-hmm.
in the truest sense. And, you know, I talk about in the book that I was orphaned when I was 5 years old. And
right.
I was lucky enough that my grandmother, she took me and my sister in, and she did not have an easy life, far from it. And
mm-hmm.
We lived in a part of Brooklyn that when I went to live with my grandmother, it was not a bad part of Brooklyn, but during the 70s, the late 60s and 70s, things changed quickly in Brooklyn. And things went from good to bad or bad to good very quickly. And this neighborhood turned sour. And we did not have the wherewithal to leave. And this woman, every day, three times a day, put together the most beautiful table for us, for me, my sister. My great-grandmother was still alive. And so the whole family was at the table. And at that table, you know, not only was recipes, not only did we eat great food, but what she was doing was passing down this food, passing down these recipes, and ultimately passing down our culture to us. And it was always
right.
at this table, no matter how bad it was outside. When we got there, it was like an oasis. And she made it very, very special. And every race and culture has a toughness to it, an inherent toughness. But I can speak from my culture, the Italian Americans. And when you say Italian Americans, it's predominantly people from southern Italy, south of Rome. And
mm-hmm.
my grandmother, she came from Naples, and my father was born in Sicily, in the northwestern part of Sicily. These were tough people. Because in Italy, anybody south of Rome, which they call the Mezzogiorno, is like garbage to them. They're low lives. They're peasants. So, you know, that's why you had such an immigration of the early 20th century, such a large immigration of southern Italians to Brooklyn. And what happens is, and you know, these houses are one on top of the other in Brooklyn, right? But you're lucky if you had a little patch of a backyard, but we're one on top of each other. So someone from Naples lives next door to someone from Sicily, who lives next door to someone from Calabria, and so on and so on. And over the years and the decades, their dialects mixed together, their cooking mixed together, and by the time I'm born and I'm now a kid, this mixture becomes what I call the Italian-American, not only culture, but cuisine. It's, you know, people, snooty people in Italy go, oh, wow, that's not Italian cooking. No, I never said it was Italian cooking. It's our cooking.
Right.
It's a, and we, like I said, the dialects don't melt it. We have our own way of speaking. My wife is went to college in Bologna for international law, and she speaks perfect Italian. But when I speak to her in our dialect, she doesn't understand every other word she catches if she's lucky. So we had our own way of, you know, our own culture, our own cooking, our own way of talking. And, you know, so that's what I really wanted people. I wanted everybody. You know, Brooklyn is a special place today. When people come
to
New York.
Brooklyn is. But I remember, like you said, though, in the, you know, I remember growing up how even just knowing people from New York, from any of the boroughs, is just kind of mythical because, you know, New York was like, it's like the nation within a nation, you know. So people that you always could tell people that were from New York, didn't matter, you know, what race or creed they wore, but you could always tell people from New York. So it's kind of a mythical place. I know you had a section in the book talking about Brooklyn, and it is kind of mythical. It's also, you know, when you say Italian American, you know, I was when I was reading the first chapter, and there was a few things in there that you wrote that I didn't even know about Italians from southern Italy, and I was like, oh, okay, this is really powerful. This is history again. Here's a history that we don't really know much about, that has contributed greatly to United States.
Yes, I mean, it's we, like I said, we came over here. You know, my father came over when he was 14. He came by himself, and and it wasn't that many years ago. I mean, I'm not 90 years old, so but typical, they came over, and for the most part, the southern Italians that came here were hardworking people. They were artisans. They were the stonemasons, the carpenters. They were good with their hands, carpenters, and so forth. And they were really, they added to the mythic part of Brooklyn. I'll tell you a funny story. When I went to France to work, I first went to the Hotel Negresco in Nice, and I basically got off the plane. I showed up at the Negresco, and you sleep in a barracks in the back. There's always like a small house behind the hotel. And, you know, all the cooks, all French. And when I told them that I came from Brooklyn, this was in 1980, 81, they didn't believe me. To them, it was just like a place in the movies or TV, that it was,
like
you say, a mythic place. It didn't really exist. And every day after work or before work, I had to tell them stories about Brooklyn. But what happens today is Brooklyn's become, it's not mythic anymore. It's become a hot place. People come, movie stars and stuff, they come to New York. They want to live in Brooklyn. Back in the 60s and 70s, that's not, you didn't want to live in Brooklyn. In fact, in the 60s and 70s, when you landed at JFK, and this is not, I'm not making this up. When you landed in JFK in those days, the city of New York gave you a pamphlet that said, "Welcome to Fear City." And there was a picture of a skeleton with a hood, with a sickle. And it told you, if you don't need to be here, turn around and leave. And it then proceeded to tell you, don't go here, don't take the subways, don't take the buses, don't go here. Today, it's a different story. So this book is also to give you a flavor of not Brooklyn today. Because I'll be honest with you, Brooklyn today is almost a little alien to me. I walk around it. They rename different sections like Dumbo. I go, where's Dumbo? People ask me, where's Dumbo? I don't know. When I was It was the Brooklyn Navy Yard when I was a kid. I don't know where Dumbo
right.
is. And so I wanted people, and mostly, most important, is now with my grandchildren. I want my grandchildren to pick up the book and get a piece of our culture to understand why I was not just nuts. You know, a lot of people think I thought I was a schoolboy when they watched me on TV and stuff. And it was coming from Brooklyn with all the color and everything like that. And I wanted my grandchildren also. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, I love the book because it does, you know, it incorporates the story as well as the food. And I love what you're saying about your grandkids, too, because you're passing down some real history here. Not just, food, but the history.
Yeah. I named the chapter, I try to not just be like funny with the chapters. It's not my point in the book.
Right.
But one of the chapters I call The Stoop. And in Brooklyn,
yes.
The Stoop growing up was one of the most important
yes.
places in the neighborhood. This is where
right.
the parents and the grandparents sat on the stoop, unless it was the dead of winter, and they policed the neighborhood. They watched the kids. They watched that no creeps were walking around the neighborhood. They watched us play. And the art of storytelling was passed down. A lot of it was passed down on the stoops. Because when
yes.
you passed by, when you heard the stories that were being told on these stoops amongst the different people, yelling from stoop to stoop and telling stories, and there was beyond belief how colorful it was. Who needed TV in those days? And it was just
right.
Not only were they passing recipes, they were passing, no matter how small, I talk about the stoop, about the gardens. No matter how small our patch of dirt was in the backyard or front yard or whatever in Brooklyn, you grew a garden. Tomatoes, eggplants, peppers, basil. For us, that was the tomatoes, eggplants, and peppers is the Holy Trinity to the Italians. So every yard
right.
had those. And at the end of the year, they jarred them. And then when you sat on the stoop, who was passing jars? And at Christmas time, a lot of times, Christmas gifts were baskets of fruit, vegetables or preparation that you made that you gave away. And it meant more than just going to the store and buying some, because this
How
was
wonderful,
a year's
yeah.
long work what went in that jar. You grew,
right.
you prepared the soil, you grew it, you cooked it, you jarred it. I mean, this was for a lot of people. You gave that to one of us or some of the people in the neighborhood. It meant more to them than a gift
right.
card or going to a big box store or something. It was a lot. And so all this kind of thing, it's part of our culture, and it's part of, what we were, what we are, and so forth. And unfortunately, now you're getting to third and fourth generations, and you're losing it a little bit, more than a little bit. It's starting to wane. You know, the old people and the young kids, the second and third generations, they didn't want to make the wine anymore. They don't want to make jar of tomatoes and stuff like that. But the surprising thing is the fourth and fifth generations, and I think this is true of a lot of cultures, is they want to know where they came from. It's more than just this, send your DNA to find out where you came from, where in the world. They want to really know where they came from. They want to know their culture. So I think it's not only for my grandchildren, but for other young kids that maybe identify with, they had family members. How many people in the United States had a grandparent or an uncle that came through Brooklyn, and they want to know, what it was like, how they grew things, what Christmas looked like, and I say about this about us. We're not so.
Well, I know that. I definitely can relate to you with. The grandkids and cooking. I mean, one of the things that I just have a great time with is cooking family recipes with my kids and my grandkids. And I'm in a time of social media, I'm surprised. one of my granddaughters, she's 13 now, but she started making bread. And I was like, oh, my goodness. So Finding out that they love to cook has been a great joy. So every time I go to visit them, we don't live in the same state. We go through our great grandmother's cookbook and like we're like, what are we going to cook? So it's fun because we cook some of the old recipes. We talk about, you know, people in the family. And then we try to figure out new recipes, you know, from the old recipes. So I really get that, you know, what you're saying. I think being able to write it like you have within, like, even though you're talking about the family in Brooklyn and you're talking about how things were, and I especially love the chapter when you said how the kitchen became the macaroni, the pasta factory, in a sense, and how, you know, everybody, you know, was in there working. And I was like, oh, wow, that's actually pretty cool. Because it is relatable to... It's relatable to other cultures, too.
Sure.
Very relatable.
Every other Friday, my grandmother, my great-grandmother, would bring out an old, it was a cookie tin full of very fine semolina flour, 00 semolina flour, come from Italy. And I say, she used to take some of the flour in her hands. They have a beautiful board on the table. And all the women and the young girls stood at different parts of a big table. And my grandmother would pick up the flour and feel it in her hands. She felt it a million times before, but she would kind of clap it together. I say, it reminded me when LeBron would clap the chalk in the air before he got on the basketball court. And once she did that, that's it. Everybody get to work. And the doughs are made and shapes that... You know, very, very old peasant shapes from Italy that have been handed down, that some of them you can't buy in a supermarket or a gourmet store. These are handed down, and these handmade pastas were, you know, so very special. And, you know, I know that, like, my cousins and so forth, they cherish those memories. And even if they don't make the pasta, they can make it if they want. But them telling stories, they hand it down. And it just was everything, like I said, was around the table. Whether it was to eat, to make the pasta, everything. We made our own sausage. I also tell stories a little disturbing, but my great-grandmother was a tough lady. Didn't speak English. And we lived, she had a tailor shop, a shoe, it was shoe repair tailor. This was before dry cleaning. So they used to press steam the clothes and so forth. And it was on a street in Brooklyn called Court Street, which was across the street from the courts. And she was a tough lady. She had a beautiful brownstone. And when my mother finally died, I went to live with them. Excuse me. And down the block, and put this in the Park Slope section of Brooklyn where her house was, there were... And there's still a few around, live chicken markets. And people don't even realize that in such a metropolis like New York and Brooklyn and so forth, that even today, there are live chicken markets, and mainly for religious reasons and cultural reasons you go by.
Right.
But this particular one was run by Hasidic Jewish people. And my great-grandmother once a year would slaughter a pig. Yes, in Brooklyn, believe it or not, she would slaughter a pig and she would make prosciutto and salami. But she used to go to the live chicken market to the Hasidic Jewish guy that ran it, who loved her eggplant parmigiana. And she would bribe him with a tray of eggplant parmigiana. And he would say to Nettie, her name was Antoinette, but they called her Nettie in Brooklyn. Nettie, do me a favor, please. Don't tell nobody I'm going to get you the pig, because Jewish people and pork, they're not supposed to have it. It's against their religion. And about a week later, he would call and say, Nettie, stop by the back door. And he would have 150, 180-pound pig draped in a burlap bag with a noose around its neck. And I was 5, 6 years old. Me and my great-grandmother, we weren't dragging the pig home. The pig was dragging us. And on the way, he passed by Nemo Columbo's fruit stand and knocked all the apples over. It took him a half a day to make it, line them up beautifully. And he'd root out the next door neighbor's geraniums, their prized geraniums, and she would get it into his backyard. And when it was ready to put the end to the misery of the big, people would close the windows and stuff. But she was such a tough lady. No one would complain like, Nettie, how do you do this in the backyard? Well, my kids and my grandkids. But, listen, it's just a fact of life. It's a lot of people, don't be disturbed by it. I don't know it. But she was just humane the way she did. But she made and showed me how to make such beautiful cured meats. And that's just, with today, with all the processing the way they do it today, doesn't taste the same. As you got to get it from small producers outside. There are some in the United States, but you still got to get them from Europe. We don't use all these chemicals and all this stuff to get this just a refined taste. And once you taste it, and you taste the refined, the processed stuff, there's something like glazed over in it. And anyway, I'm going on along with the tangent.
Well, I was going to say too.
Also, I talked about.
Well, I was going to say too, though, but I think that a lot of families, even the young ones that you're, the millennials, are wanting to get back to growing their own gardens and canning their own, their own vegetables and, things to have around the house. And a lot of them are going, they're going to the, I know I am going to the farmer's market for my vegetables and stuff. There's, because it's a little bit fresher and it's not a lot of stuff on it, but also, people are the butchers are actually doing better business now because people are wanting to go to the butcher instead of going to the supermarket getting meat. But
my grandmother always used to say she prepared a garden in the early spring, and she would always say, "We don't farm vegetables. We don't grow. We farm the soil." And the vegetables is a byproduct. So they would walk to, in the middle of Brooklyn. There's a very famous park called Prospect Park. And in there were stables, and they got horses for the kids, like ponies and stuff for the kids to ride, and the carriages to go around the park and so forth. So she would go and carry home 100 pounds to 50-pound sacks of horse manure. And they never threw anything. This is before composting and the terms of composting and heirloom and so they never threw coffee grounds away. They never threw eggshells away. This is long before the Victory Garden, And so they were already doing these kind of things. I mean, they didn't throw nothing away. I mean, really, almost nothing went in the garbage. That everything was used and recycled. And they prepared the soil, and then they would get seeds from Italy. So they were growing these, what we know today is heirloom. Today say, there's a GMO. They don't know back then what GMO. They got these heirloom tomatoes and peppers and eggplants, and they were extraordinary. And, I look at the stuff today that I see, like on these very fancy, I grow it too, and I say, I remember these tomatoes when I was a kid. That's what they were growing. I mean, and the other thing was, another tradition that we passed down is my great-grandmother, when I was 5-6 years old, would take me to, in Brooklyn, there was an old cemetery, 200-year-old cemetery, called Holy Cross Cemetery, where our family was buried. And she would take me by the hand to the cemetery every week. But after a rainstorm, if there was a rainstorm a day or two before, she would bring an old silver tablespoon and a basket. And she would take me to a far part, desolate part of the cemetery, and under oak trees there were mushrooms growing from the rain, and she would point the mushrooms out and she would tell me, take them, but don't take them all. See, she without knowing it, they were conservation, because if she takes them all, there would be no spores to grow mushrooms later. So take some, we would take them home, and she would have us an old silver quarter, a quarter before when it was really silver. And she would cook the mushrooms, and she'd throw the quarter in. And if the quarter turned dark, she'd throw the mushrooms out to say they're poison. But, so people said to me when I told the story today, I had a quarter in the pen. That's an old wives' tale. Maybe. But she was 87 years old. She never poisoned nobody in 87 years. And then I become chef of La Caravelle. And finally, in those days, New York, you started getting wild mushrooms from California and Oregon and stuff. And this French guy, mushroom guy, brings in this beautiful basket of what they call hen of the woods mushrooms. They're very expensive. I mean, in those days, I'm talking in the late 80s and early 90s, it was like $35 a pound. That was a lot of money for a mushroom. And he said to me, I says, I started to say without thinking, I know those mushrooms. I used to pick them when I was a kid. And he said to me, where did you pick these mushrooms? And I said, I caught myself, my brother's guy, in front of all these chefs. I picked them in a cemetery. They're going to think I'm a ghoul or something. Oh, no, when I was in Europe, I picked them. I don't want to tell them. But those were the same mushrooms that we used to pick in the cemetery. So, and these
wow.
were not a tradition that was passed down, you know, and wonderful. Wonderful memories. I mean, really.
Well, you also have when you're talking about making, you're talking about making pork, which is really kind of interesting because I guess I never really thought about the fish and the pork that's in some of the Italian dishes, and I guess because when you go across, when you start going west, it's not like the same Italian food that you get back east. Now, my mom would not get a corned beef sandwich in any place but Cleveland, Ohio. If she would be like, when she went home to visit, she's like, I got to get a corned beef, sandwich. She would not buy it because we lived in California at the time. But when she went home, she would get corned beef, but she would never buy it in California. It was always had to buy it at home. But on here, you make artisanal cheeses, and you use an ancient method that you were taught in France. What is that?
Well, in France, when you go to some of the best cheeses in France, and in Italy too, they're made by dairy farmers. Because the dairy farmers, they milk the cows, or not just the cow, but sheep or goat or whatever, they're one of the three. And surplus milk is made. They have surplus milk, so they make them into cheeses. But the old farms in France, these the rooms where they make the cheese and they age the cheese and so forth, they've been handed down from generation to generation to generation. And there is a mold in there. There's good mold and bad mold. When people hear mold, for some things if you see mold, you throw in the garbage. When it comes to cheese, there's good mold and bad mold. And the French, I saw how they used good mold to create their cheeses. And this good, when you use powdered, today modern people that make cheese, they get, enzymes and all these powdered things, and they mix them into the whole milk and so forth. And it works, and the cheeses are good. Don't get me wrong. But when you make it, it's like you mentioned your granddaughter making bread. It's like when the sourdough starter that they hand for months or years on a bread, they keep that starter going. It's the same with cheese. This mold, sourdough bread made with an old starter, has a flavor, a richness, and a deepness, deep taste. You can't take yeast and make it. It ain't coming out the same. It's the same with cheese. When you take this and it survives and it keeps going, this culture, it creates the cheese, a natural culture that's on your hands, that's on the board. It's always on your hands. It's always on the board or so forth. It gets incorporated into the milk, whatever kind of milk you're using. It produces a cheese you just can't replicate with modern thing. It's a richness, a deepness that you say, where is that? It's like a layers of flavor, like with the bread, that you just, there's an aroma to the bread or to the cheese, and there's a reason why we eat bread and cheese together, and there's an aroma and a layering of flavors that you can't get. You got to use the old methods. So when I stopped working in the restaurants, one of the things I started doing was making cheese, and he was incorporating that old style methods of doing the cheese. Like I saw the farmers when I was in France, when I worked in France. And like I said, in Italy too, they do the same thing with the Italian version of the cheeses and so forth. And it's an enjoyable thing. It's not just a delicious thing. I love to do it. It's enjoyable. It's a wonderful
thing. Good. Don't you think that there's also a joy in, because when you're talking about, you know, making the cheese, I think there's a joy in doing it the old-fashioned way, but also in the time. It's not rush. It's not, you know, let's hurry up and do this. It's something about the time it takes to do it and to do it the right way and get the flavor. Because, you know, I used to watch my mom make dough. I could never make dough. I was the only person in the family couldn't make dough. But everybody in the family had a special dish they could make. But I used to watch my mom, and she used to say, you know, there was just a certain way you do it. You have to have real patience when you're cooking good food. Okay, because it can't be rushed. Yeah, there is a beauty to it.
There's a beauty to it. And you can't rush beauty. It takes time. And it takes time to show the person that she's showing. They can't learn it in 5 seconds. You know, that's another thing. Things that took people a lifetime to learn, you're not going to learn it in 5 seconds. And, you know, so to watch people do the old style, you know, just because you used to be, when you say, he's old fashioned, the old fashioned is, was a negative thing. Today,
right.
I don't think that's true anymore. Like I said, the young children, they want to know where everything came from. You know,
right.
They want to learn, whereas their parents didn't want to know. They wanted to be modern, and they are, no, they want to know. And like you say, your mother, the way she needs the bread and so forth, and there's not just that it takes time. There's a feel to it. When you're using your hands and you feel that bread, or you feel the dough when you're making pasta, or when you feel the curd when you're making cheese and so forth, there's a feel to it that you cannot express in words. You know, unless you feel it and you've done it, you smell it, you just can't express those things in words. And that's why I feel good about the book in that I try to, I can't, you know, give you every 1,000% in the book, but I give you the guidelines to take some of these recipes. Some of them are quick, but some of them are not. But on those nights or those weekends,
Well, I also like that you had, I love the section called the pantry, okay? I loved that section. But I also want to talk about, let's talk about you cooking for 5 U.S. presidents. Which 5 U.S. presidents did you cook for?
Well, when I started to think about it, write my biography, it was 4. But then the 5th was elected. So Trump was the 5th. Please, nobody, this is not political. He was the 5th.
Right.
But obviously he wasn't the president when I cooked for him. Carter, Ford, Nixon on many occasions. And Nixon, these were all at Le Caravelle, except Trump, but I had him at other restaurants too. Nixon was a Francophile, spoke beautifully French, really knew his wines, Burgundy wines. But I tell you the funny thing is that Henry Kissinger used to eat at the restaurant also, and they never spoke a word to each other. They wouldn't even look at each other. But he was Mr. Nixon was a very nice man. And the 5th one was the only sitting president. And that was, I'll tell you, there was a president in the Philippines named Aquino, and he was assassinated. And his wife took over as the president. And she was under a lot of pressure, and she needed to meet Ronald Reagan, and Uh-huh. We took Carousel across the street was the Peninsula Hotel. She was staying at the Peninsula, and she came to they had lunch at the Carousel to meet. And at the end of the lunch, the kitchen was in the basement, and there was Secret Service everywhere. And my back was to the stairs from the dining room, and I saw the Secret Service men get very stiff and very nervous. And I turned around, and standing right behind me was President Reagan. And he shook my hand, and he said, "It's such a unbelievable to see a young American at the running a restaurant, this French restaurant, so well known and so forth." And so about a week or two later, I got a letter from the White House. So, of course, you figure it's one of those printed out, just they sent to everybody, right? And I opened it up, and I was shocked. I still have it. He handwrote, and I knew it was him. He knew what he ate. He knew what he said to me in the kitchen and so forth. And he saw President Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan. It was an extraordinary experience. And,
wow.
Carousel was an extraordinary place. It really was. Unfortunately, it's gone now. But, and I'm pre-COVID, those type of restaurants started disappearing because people today don't dine anymore, particularly in New York, where everybody's on the run. They eat. And the minute you stop dining and that, there was a pomp and circumstance to eating, whether it was lunch or dinner and so forth, there was a decorum. When that went out the window, so did those type of restaurants. And that was, not only a lot of those type of French restaurants in New York, that was the kiss of death for them. But in its time, the Carousel was an extraordinary place, really was. And
I bet it was.
We were 42 in the kitchen, and I was the only American when I first started working there. And I worked there, and then I went to France, then I came back, and like you said before, I became the chef when I was 25. And when I was in France, in New York, there still is a nationwide magazine called W. It's the weekly of Women's Wear Daily, and the name of the publisher's name was Fairchild. Fairchild had more power for restaurants in New York than the New York Times, you name them. He made or break the restaurant. And what happened was is that the owner of La Carousel was notorious for being a little harsh with people. And Ralph, when I was in Europe, Ralph Lauren had come to La Carousel. The owner was at the door, and he maintained the suit and tie, very strict. And Ralph Lauren came in with one of, he had that tie, it was really a tie, it was like a rope. And the owner's name was Maison. He said, "I'm sorry, I'm not letting you in. You got to put a tie. You got a crummy tie out of that coat check. He's going to put this tie on." He said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Do you know who I am?" He says, "That's not a tie. That's what you tie horses with outside in the street. So you can leave now." And what happened was this Fairchild, running Women's Wear Daily and so forth, Ralph Lauren told the story, and all the designers stopped going to La Carousel. And when I came back, I started cooking, and a few weeks after I started cooking with Carousel, Fairchild showed up with Alan Wertheimer, who was the head of Chanel, and so forth. He asked me to cook for him, and I did. And he called me up in the dining room, and the next week he gave me a 3-page spread in W Magazine. Extraordinary. And all the designers came back, including Pierre Cardin, who a year later hired me away to take over Maxim's in New York on Madison Avenue. So,
oh my goodness, that's awesome. We just passed Christmas, and I want to know, how important to you is it? What's the importance for you of food, family, and holidays? Why is this so important to you?
Well, it's the premier time to pass on our culture. So, there's a lot of traditions we have. And a week before Christmas, my wife and all the women and some of the men in the family get together and they cook Christmas, Italian-style Christmas cookies. And I mean a lot of cookies. It is a two-day affair where they make tins, 80, 90 tins of cookies, all handmade, all beautifully made. And that, like, launches the Christmas season for us. And then it leads up to Christmas Eve. And for the Italian-Americans, Christmas Eve is no meat, only fish. And a lot of it's either they say the seven fishes or the 12th is a lot. The 12 fish, we have 12 fish on Christmas Eve. Whether the original concept came from the 12 apostles, I don't know. But bacala, which is salt cod and calamari and the shrimp and lobster and eel, which is very important and so forth. And that's what we eat on Christmas Eve. And the dinner on Christmas Eve lasts for 4 hours, sometimes five hours. And every Christmas we do it. And then Christmas Day, early for the kids. And then later on we have a regular, our regular meal, which is always always has pasta. The lasagna is usually the dish. And then roasted meats and salad and so forth. And kids of our family and the grandchildren, now they don't only learn about it, they expect it, they know. And it's a wonderful time. And, I was saying, no one's going to fault the Italians in Brooklyn from being subtle. And there's a part of Brooklyn called Dyker Heights. And there's one street in Dyker Heights, 85th Street, that's six blocks long. And I show two pictures in the book of the Christmas decorations in the houses. And I challenge any neighborhood, not a house, any neighborhood as a whole, to outdo Dyker Heights. They have nearly a million people every year come to 85th Street and Dyker Heights from all over the country, because it's not just the decorations. The people in the houses come out dressed up as Santa Claus and the elves and giving out candy canes. And the police are there to make sure no one slows down, because the traffic jams are unbelievable. And there's people with roasted chestnuts. And it's just it just is a wonderful time of the year.
That's wonderful.
So you
hosted Ruggiero to Go on the Food Network and A Little Italy with David Ruggiero on PBS. How did you like hosting those food programs?
How I ended up on TV, and I didn't start out being that comfortable on television. Robert Mondavi at one point decided he wanted to find the 13 best chefs in America. And of the 13, each would get a half-hour show, because on PBS, series are 13 or 26. So he says, 13 chefs, each one gets a half-hour show. And I got picked as one of the 13 best in America. And he put me on.
Okay.
And I have to thank him, because without him, I don't know if I ever would have got to TV. And the people that produced it, they were PBS, produced Little Italy. And I really, in the beginning, it was a little, I was not that comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happened was that there was a chef on Food Network called Sarah Malkin. Wonderful, wonderful girl, or woman, wonderful chef. She was also the chef for Gourmet Magazine. But she used to do a very difficult show, 5 days a week, live from 7 to 8, where she cooked live and took live telephone calls from people. And that's very hard to do when you're working a full-time job and then you got to go in there and take calls. So she started getting tired, and they started looking for somebody to fill in. So I used to fill in when she was too tired to do the show. But I started to get comfortable talking with people on the phone, and I started to become a little bit off the wall. And one day, I got into it with somebody on the phone, and I got called into the office of the head of programming at Food Network. Her name was Eileen Oputat, and I thought she was going to tell me, get out and never come back. And she said to me, how would you like your own TV show? I thought it was a gag. I was looking around to see if there was someone hiding in cars. I said, come on, you kidding me or what? Was it a gag? No, I'm serious. And 3 months later, Ruggiero to Go was a reality, and I loved it. I enjoyed it. It was in the street. It wasn't just cooking in the studio in front of a live audience, but also I made up stories, excuse me, and we went out and with people and colorful people, a lot of people in Brooklyn and so forth, and I had a lot of fun, and it changed my life. And it took me, because, you know, being a chef, famous chef in a French restaurant has a limited audience. Television, whole different ballgame, because now the average person in the street knows who you are. So it really changed my life, and I can't say I didn't like it. I enjoyed it, and it was great times for me.
Well, you're such a, you know, you are such a diverse author as well as, you know, person. I really enjoyed this book from the beginning to the end. I love the recipes and the little notes you had on there. And I am excited to try a couple of them on here because I love sardines, and it's kind of like, oh, there's a really dish recipe for sardines, not just the can. Right. So, and there's some things in here. It's like zucchini. It's like zucchini is not my favorite vegetable, but looking at your cookbook here and reading these stories, I'm like, zucchini could be on the menu for me. But I love Mediterranean food, so this was great. But it was also great reading your story and reading a lot of the history in here. So what is your next project? Because I know you're not just sitting around. You have another project. So what's your next project?
I'm putting the finishing touches on my memoir because I kind of skimmed over in the book some of the events of my life and so forth. But there's a lot more to the story. And it's a lot.
Yes.
Some of it's surprising. Some of it's shocking. And it'll probably be out at the end of the year. And it was not easy to write. Like I said to you, I was orphaned when I was five. So there are parts of the book that were very, very difficult and dark to write about. But
I bet.
It's colorful. Guarantee you that anybody in the audience will be entertained by the stories in the books and so forth. So
yes, definitely.
That's my...
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, also, I want to say to our listening audience that you have to check out David's website as well. We'll make sure that you have the link to the website because he has a great little blog on there as well. I mean, it's we can't do all of David in one interview. Okay, so I encourage you to go to his website and check out his website and check out the books that he has. This is a great book. It's an interesting story. I love I love the way you weaved in pantry, the food, because it gives a little bit more flavor to it as well as the story when you're talking about in the pantry. I keep saying the pantry because I love it when you're talking about the difference between the olive oils and the white pepper and the black pepper, and it's just kind of things that you really don't really know about, but it's something that would be that's really interesting for me because, you know, your book is focused on Italian American, but just to read all those different things, it's like, oh, okay, interesting. It really is interesting, and it makes me think about what my garden is going to have in it. Go ahead.
I think it's important because people are cooking more and more today.
Yes. And I think they're really because there is, you know, I get great joy from cooking, so I love cooking. And a lot of my friends are actually going back to cooking good food. And so, like I said, the whole pantry thing, because I love seasonings. I love herbs. But I don't like it. I don't like when you go to the store and you buy something in a can or in a bottle. I actually like going to the little markets and buying it fresh. I like learning how to take care of it, you know, when you get it at home, how to take care of it. So that's a lot of what I'm learning. But this was great. I'm going to be advertising this on our radio. Everybody, you'll be hearing this program tomorrow, but you'll also see it in our section on Vertical Life magazine called The Cultural Chef. And that's where we have different people in there. But this is going to be great to feature David and his book and talk a little bit about his story.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. So, David, any last comments you want to make to us?
I think that the Italian American journey is not unique to us. Everybody
mm-hmm.
listening can relate to it, depending on where their culture is, wherever they came from. They can relate to this story. And it's very similar to many, many different cultures in this country. And that's what makes this country so wonderful. And it's just, this is my story, where I came from, because I'm damn proud of it and damn proud of being Italian-American and so forth. But, like I said, everybody, even if you're not Italian-American, you can relate to it. And the recipes are good. You'll enjoy it. Some are simple, some are more complicated, but it's the type of food. There's a reason why Italian cooking is one of the most popular cuisine in the world. There's a good reason for it. And I think that your listeners, go to the website first, check out a few of the recipes before you buy the book. You'll see you'll like it. They really, they look great in the pictures, but when you cook it, you're going to smell better and forget about the taste. Knock your socks off.
Well, David, me and you have to do this again where we're, you know, talking more about food or your next book that's coming up, because this has been really great.
When I run into you, I'm going to cook for you. That's what I'm going to do. That's what I got to do for you.
I would love that. And thank you. Thank you so much for, gracing our program. Sound like you got a little cold going on there. So I hope you're taking care of yourself there. But thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's truly been a pleasure.
It's really an honor to be on your show, and I really appreciate it.
Okay. So, everyone, again, this has been David Ruggiero, and we're talking about his book, A Tomato Grows in Brooklyn. And like I said, we'll be advertising this tomorrow on our social media so you can listen more to this program and David. And we'll have where you'll be able to pick up this book. And like David said, check out the website. Oh, you got to check the website out because there's more on the website. So, David, you take care. And thank you again for being in our program. And we're just going to be keeping in touch with you, okay? And I'm going to take you up on that cooking a meal, okay?
I'm telling
for
you.
For sure.
But thanks so much. And God bless everybody. Everybody stay safe.
God bless. You take care. Bye-bye.
Right,
everyone, thank you so much for being a part of our program. And as you know, we had David on before, and I love David, and it was great having him on this time. So thank you. We appreciate you. We'll be posting this program tomorrow on Vertical Life Magazine and our social media.
Thank you to our faithful listeners. This has been Living Vertical Radio, and you have been listening to our host, Cecine Duckworth. Stay tuned to our next program. Interested in getting your business in front of a worldwide audience? Contact info@verticalmediagroup.com. That's info@verticalmediagroup.com for details. And now, a word from our sponsors.
Books that make you laugh, books that make you scream, books that make you hope, and books that make you dream. What's on your bookshelf? Discover the books that make you who you are on booksthatmakeyou.com. Read book reviews. Meet the authors who pour their souls into the books you love. And enter to win bookish prizes. If you're a bibliophile, then Books That Make You is your new best friend. Visit booksthatmakeyou.com or find us on Insta and Facebook.